This podcast was recorded before it had been officially announced that Dominic Cummings had left Number 10. However, I think the episode should still be interesting as a look at Dominic Cummings' successes and failings while in government. Welcome to Politics Unpacked, the series where we explain one of the biggest news topics of the day, then debate the issue with the TLDR team. In recent days, there's been a lot of talk about one of Johnson's key advisers, Dominic Cummings. So, with Cummings set to leave Downing Street for good at the end of the year, we wanted to take the chance to discuss his impact, and whether he's really the master of the dark political arts, or just a dude who was lucky to win two elections. This is Politics Unpacked. This episode of the podcast actually started with an argument. The other day when Cummings' resignation was being discussed, TLDR writers Ben and Zach got into a bit of a disagreement on the TLDR Slack. Turns out they have very different views on the advisor and the media coverage surrounding him. So I essentially told them to stop talking on Slack and get some microphones in front of them. So in a moment, you're going to hear that discussion, argument, debate, whatever it was. And they'll discuss whether Cummings is the Svengali that the media often portray him to be. Before we start though, a bit of background. Dominic Cummings, while probably most famous for an ill-fated trip to Barnard Castle during the pandemic, actually first came into public consciousness during the Brexit referendum. That's because in 2016, Cummings was the director of the Leave campaign, which, as the name suggests, helped spearhead the effort to leave the European Union. The vote to leave and the success of Vote Leave surprised a lot of people in the political establishment, and put Cummings' name truly on the map. So it wasn't all that surprising that when fellow Brexiteer and Vote Leave figurehead Boris Johnson became Prime Minister in 2019, Cummings got a call from Number 10. Johnson invited Cummings to Downing Street to become the chief advisor to the Prime Minister. So special was that request that Johnson had actually invented this role, effectively replacing the Downing Street chief of staff. Regardless, Cummings was immediately planted into the heart of government, right by Johnson's side. Since then though, Cummings hasn't been popular with everyone, with him having a particularly difficult relationship with former Chancellor Sajid Javid, ultimately leading to Javid's resignation because he refused to accept Cummings' plans to bring the Chancellor and Number 11 closer to him in Number 10. He also, and more notably, caused a stir in May when he made a trip to Durham during the lockdown, against the government's own advice. As I'm sure you'll remember, this led to a lot of controversy, and led to even more conversations about Cummings. A lot of the media conversation about him tends to ask the question, is Cummings a grandmaster of political strategy, able to win two major votes and shape the political system to his will? Or is he out of depth? Was he just lucky that the tide was already turning towards Brexit in 2016? And, well, the 29 opposition wasn't all that strong. That's exactly what Zach and Ben will discuss right now in Politics Unpacked.
Okay, well, why don't you start? Why don't you give... to give people listening a bit of context, I probably lean more towards Cummings being... I think he's a smart bloke, but his political success is mostly luck.
I disagree. I think he has had some smart strategies in the past.
You think he's the dark arts,
man? I do. I think he's managed to use a lot of tools which politicians have been reluctant to use in the past and has used them to his advantage massively, specifically in the Brexit referendum. I think 2019 election wasn't... he did well, but I don't think that was...
Have I convinced you of that?
No,
now?
We
had a little conversation about this over text, yeah. And Jack persuaded us that we should make it.
He didn't persuade. He told us.
He did. he told me. I still have some autonomy.
I don't have
you employee.
Yeah, exactly. I was told I'd be doing this
anyway. What are some concrete political examples where Cummings has done well?
Yeah. So I think that the most concrete was the Brexit referendum, and I think specifically the way that he. And we did speak about this, and obviously this is for everybody else, but we had a disagreement over the Vote Leave being separate from Leave EU. For those of you who don't know, the EU referendum, the Leave campaigns were split. There was two campaigns that were running at the same time. There was Leave EU, which was headed by Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks.
Yeah.
Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks, and then there was the Vote Leave. I always used to get these confused, but Vote Leave was run by Dominic Cummings, and they used different tactics in the way they ran their campaigns, and they appealed to different bases of supporters, whereas the Remain campaign had Labour, you know, Labour MPs with Conservative MPs, which just didn't, which were struggling to put out a unified message.
And I think importantly, a half-hearted Labour leadership.
With Corbyn going on the last leg and saying he was, 7 out of 10 in support of the EU, which when you're running, you know, a Remain campaign is not the message you want to be sending, irrespective of whether you are or aren't only 7 out of 10 for the EU. Saying that in the middle of a referendum is not a smart political move in the slightest.
No.
So anyway, we had a disagreement. I think that Dominic Cummings' approach there was smart, and it was using the split between the two Leave campaigns effectively. Now, you were saying that wasn't as a result of Dominic Cummings, and I agree with you that the actual split itself wasn't a result of Dominic Cummings or wasn't planned, but the way that he used that to his advantage was an intelligent move and was a smart move and was using the situation that had been given to him to his benefit.
It was clever, or his decision. I think the interesting question is how effective Vote Leave actually was.
Yeah, fine. I'm not saying that it was the decision to split. It was the decision to run the campaign the way he did after the split. I'm not attributing the split to him. I'm attributing the actions of the Vote Leave afterwards to him,
You're just pointing out their split so that we can attribute what Vote Leave did to Dominic Cummings and not to some combination of Dominic Cummings and Farage, and so Cummings gets credit for Vote Leave.
I
think that's fair, but then the question
leads us on to the question that you've raised, which is exactly what did Vote Leave do and why can they be the ones attributed. And my answer to that would be, firstly, simple messaging and being able to tie the EU to problems that people had felt with the political elite over the last decade. So there was a growing disdain for the political elite, and that wasn't necessarily directed towards the EU in the years prior. It was just directed towards the political elite generally. Now, Farage went some of the way in attributing that to the EU, but I think the Vote Leave campaign was largely responsible for being able to direct that anger at the EU and blame the EU for problems. Now, they did a lot of different things. You know, take back control was a very snappy, short slogan which was enforced on people. Now, I mean, if we're going back ever so slightly, you know, Lynton Crosby ran the 2015 Tory general election campaign. He had 5 years to do that. And one of the things that he did was really ruthlessly telling people about these sound bites and making sure they kept repeating themselves. I think David Cameron even found himself a little bit frustrated because they just had to keep saying the same things over and over. Dominic Cummings did the same thing in 2016 with, you know, Vote Leave, take back control. You know, get hammering home this message that, it, you know, that if they want to take power back to these disenfranchised communities, these communities that are, you know, frustrated with the political elite, you can do that very simply in the EU referendum. That very simple messaging. And the second point, so that's the first point. The second point is the Cambridge Analytica. Now, morally speaking, obviously, you know, it's not great, but the way that he used that and he used advances in technology to directly target certain people and alter the message to certain communities to get them on side, I think was another smart move. So they're the two points I'd make. Do you disagree with either of those?
I think you've got 3 points there. You've got, haven't you? You've got simple messaging.
Yeah.
You've got redirecting sort of pre-existing antagonisms towards the EU.
Yeah.
And then you've got, thirdly, the use of technology.
I'd say the second one was kind of like, you know, tied to the first and the third. So yeah, okay, two to three don't matter. But yes, they were my points. Yeah.
Okay. So what I would say, well, let's just go through them one by one. The first one is simple messaging. Fine. Yeah. He definitely does that well. I will actually give him that much. There's actually a really good Rory Stewart anecdote where he says that before the leadership, because when Cummings was obviously in the background of the Conservative leadership election.
Yeah.
And must have been the first debate, Stewart met with Cummings, and Cummings said, "You've just got to get Brexit done." And Rory Stewart thought, that's a good slogan, I'm going to use that. And then when he got on stage, every single leadership candidate also said, "Get Brexit done." And Cummings had obviously met with all of them and given each of them the same three-word slogan.
Yeah.
And Get Brexit Done was a great three-word slogan. Take Back Control, I don't know what its real efficacy was, but it's pretty good. I'll give them that much. Mm. So I think the simple messaging, fair enough. I think the real reason the simple messaging looks so good is not because it's particularly clever. It's more because Remain was useless, and Remain's message was complicated economics about tariffs and customs. And those two next to each other, obviously a simple Take Back Control looks better than you don't want your pork to get more expensive. And on the redirecting antagonisms thing, I just think this is interesting because this is what people normally give Cummings credit for. And for that matter, Vote Leave and Brexit and all those campaigns and Farage. You take pre-existing antagonisms and you redirect them towards the political class or whichever sort of movement you want. You redirect them towards the EU or the incumbent party, whatever it's going to be.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to note that this, I looking across Europe and for that matter, even into the US, I think it's clear that actually that was quite an organic redirection because it happened everywhere. It happened in Germany. It happened in Italy. It happened in the Netherlands. It even happened in France. And all of these places saw this sort of 2016 through to about late 2017 redirection of political angst towards the EU. And
you think that was what, just coincidence?
I think fundamentally that was a symptom of the 2015 migrant crisis. And I think that the EU as a whole took a very liberal stance on that, and it was the motivating factor for most of the political consequences.
I won't disagree with you that there was, you know, frustrations with the EU following the you know, the migrant crisis, but the point still remains that in those countries, though, the you know, Eurosceptic parties, Eurosceptic
didn't
know,
do
groups
as well as Brexit. No. Yeah, well, that's a point worth pointing. But there's, you have to understand that there are two exceptionally relevant UK differences here. Well, there's three if we include Cummings, but I don't think Cummings is the relevant one here. I think the two differences are levels of latent Euroscepticism in the UK. The EU does a Eurobarometer poll. We come about second historically for how little we like the
yes.
EU.
Yeah.
It's not the same in France. I mean, the fact that the AfD, who were anti-EU in Germany, got 13% of the vote in 2017, whatever their general election was, is amazing because Germany is the EU, you see.
Mm.
And I mean, the fact that Le Pen got 30% of the vote in the French presidential election, the fact that Geert Wilders was the second largest party in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
All of these things are amazing. But the reason that the UK's was so extreme is because we had such higher levels of latent Euroscepticism. We never really felt European. And the one other thing I would say is that I think this is so, it's just people forget this fact that the British media, and especially the tabloid media, has been running ridiculous bendy banana anti-EU stories
largely
for the last
Johnson.
30 years. Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about this. You had The Sun, The Daily Mail, writing endless shit about that sort of thing, about how the EU was stopping us from doing this, Brussels bureaucrats, that sort of nonsense. You actually had Johnson working at both The Spectator and The Telegraph, spouting similar things. The vast majority of the British media has been peddling this line to sort of subconscious collective psyche of your average British man, or average British person, I should say. And I think when you take those two facts, I mean, obviously isolating the variable is very difficult here, and trying to figure out exactly how much of an impact Vote Leave / Cummings had is difficult. But I do think that when you take into the fact that we have such high levels of latent Euroscepticism, and we have a media that has been bashing the EU for God knows how long, it is unsurprising that in 2016, when the rest of Europe was seeing a similar upsurge in EU scepticism, Euroscepticism, a slight majority of the British population decided not to go for it. I would say the last thing, I don't think Cummings can take much credit for redirecting that either, because the main reason that this, essentially, this political angst about stasis, about how nothing had really happened in British politics for a very long time, which I think is the best way of describing it, no? It's sort of establishment being useless.
Yeah.
The reason that was directed at the EU is actually because it was directed at Remain. Remain was the most archetypally establishment conglomerate you could hope for. I mean, it was, apart from Jeremy Corbyn, perhaps, who was reluctant, it was Tony Blair, it was David Cameron,
Obama.
I mean, it was just, you see what I mean? If you wanted to personify, quote unquote, that nebulous term, the establishment, you would have just lined up everyone in Remain. And that is what redirected that political, what's the word that everyone uses? Disenfranchisement. That's
yes,
the word.
Yeah.
That is what realigned that disenfranchisement, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with you that, and obviously, I mean, I did some work at uni on this, and yeah, the UK has been, of all the European countries, like, through polling, definitively felt the least European, and they've demonstrated that for a long time. I agree with you, and I agree that Cummings's job would have been easier in the UK than any other European nation. But the fact remains that translating, disenfranchisement with the EU into an actual vote to leave. I mean, people are annoyed at the EU. People are annoyed at, levels of bureaucracy. But people are annoyed with Westminster. People are annoyed at a lot of things. They don't vote to get rid of them just on the back of that. That needs translated. That needs to be translated.
Well, I know. And that's why I think that's what I meant by when that translation was done for Cummings, for Brexiteers, by the fact that Remain was just the establishment. It was all of the Westminster establishment. That's why post-2016 there was so much political commentary about how this was a blow to the establishment. It wasn't necessarily directed solely at the EU. It was also directed at everyone who was cheerleading for the EU, who were the establishment. So that redirecting was entirely done for Cummings. That was circumstantial.
Yeah, no, I understand that, and I understand that there was, and as you point out, there was also the migrant crisis, and there was the fact that the stars sort of aligned to make things easier. But there was the thing that I think you're kind
really
of downplaying.
Yeah.
But the thing that I think you're downplaying here is that you're making it out as if it was always just going to be really easy with the establishment all together against Cummings, as if that just definitively makes things easier for them. People have got to remember as well that when the establishment all band together, you have a massive amount of wealth, amount of power, a lot of influence over people to try and to get a vote to go one way. Yes, it makes the job of campaigning
very
against
quickly
them.
But that's normally true because the establishment normally includes the media. This was not true in the Brexit case because there's very little you can do as the quote-unquote establishment with a lot of money when the vast majority of the British media, or as it's consumed, is anti-EU in any sort of election. But like, here's a good example. The Conservatives have an advantage in elections, yeah? This establishment Conservative Party, which I think is a fair thing to call Boris Johnson, yeah, have an advantage in that, yes, they have a lot of wealth, they have an incumbency advantage, and also, importantly, they have, for the most part, the backing of the media, yeah?
Yep.
Daily Mail are pretty nice to them, The Telegraph pretty nice to them. You know, and when Tony Blair was the establishment, the Daily Mail and Telegraph were nice to him. Yeah? Yeah, so that is one of the important advantages for the quote-unquote establishment. The difference here was that the quote-unquote establishment in the Brexit campaign, the Remainers, yeah, as we're calling them, didn't have the support of the media. You're right, they had a lot of money behind them, but they didn't have the support of the media.
And
so it's not Cummings fighting against the establishment as it normally is. It's not like he's fighting a clever media campaign back against this sort of incumbency media that's propping up the establishment. He had the whole force of the Telegraph, the Sun, all the tabloid papers behind him. And I'm not even suggesting he was spearheading, but he was part of that whole movement. He was just swept along with it. The relevant counterfactual is, let's assume that Vote Leave never existed. Yeah, what do you think the outcome would have been?
How do you determine that? I still,
yeah, it's a difficult counterfactual. There's a lot of other things going on, but let's say Cummings never born. Yeah,
right.
And instead, you've just got Farage shouting off ballot, but then you've got the Sun, the Telegraph, the Daily Mail, Boris Johnson.
I don't think there was a unifying figure to unify the more political moderates away from the Nigel Farage people to lead an effective campaign. I think that the thing that Cummings did, which I think that I agree with you on all the points that you've raised, I do think the media were, I mean, definitively the media were more pro-Brexit than other things. I still than they were pro-Remain. I certainly agree with that. But I still think that you needed somebody to unify a campaign and to lead an effective campaign. Without an effective campaign, that I genuinely don't think you'd be able to translate the vote.
Okay, well, this
I
is
think
a, this
that people
is,
are annoyed at the political system, example. But to vote against the political system is a big thing to do. And I definitely think that you needed somebody as that sort of unifying
perfect.
Figure to
all
be able
right.
to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, let's do this. So I think that's a really good argument. I think that you're right, you do need unifying figures. Cummings is not a unifying figure. And
I think in that campaign he was.
I don't think, I think that's hard, that you'll be hard-pressed to argue that. I don't think Cummings has ever been a unifying figure. Cummings is famously not particularly good at, so you know, politics with a small p. And I think the current administration is testament to that.
Yes, fine. I think we need to differentiate what we both mean here by unifying. I meant unifying in a base of supporters. I presume you mean unifying in the actual political agents.
Yeah, I thought that's what you meant.
No, I mean like a base of, like,
oh,
like
okay.
unifying
a coalition
supporters
of electorate.
Of, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, I don't... Well, I mean, I think we're just going to end up having to disagree here. I just don't...
And to be fair, I think we are going to have to disagree here, and that's fine. But the point, I think one of the better points as well about this is the Cambridge Analytica thing.
Oh, yeah, we haven't talked about that. Yeah,
I think that is one of the big things. And I think that is one of the reasons he was able to do this unifying job of a base of supporters. And I think that was something good. And I think we spoke about this in the Slack chat, and you were saying that people have used social media for a long time. And again, agree with you. Obama 2008, famously very good with that. Totally agree, understand that. Even 2015 with the Tories, actually, they were pretty good with media relations and using social media to their own advantage. The point is with Cambridge Analytica is I think that was a different beast. That was using targeted advertising, very specific targeted advertising. I think specifically, was it they claimed to have 5,000 plus data points per individual in America, that was, but you know, it's the same company. I don't know how many they had in the UK, but they had a lot of data points on each person, and they were able to, you know, specify specific adverts for each individual voter to try and play on what might get them to vote a certain way. And you know, if you go back through the history of, you know, campaigning with politics, it is trying to, I mean, I agree that it's wrong, I agree that you shouldn't do it, but it is the I think it's the next step in what political advertising is always going to be. Advertising is all trying to get people to do something you want them to do. And I think that people draw this line of when it becomes sinister. You know, even if you were to advertise someone to try and buy a TV that they might not already, you know, naturally before the advert wants, you're trying to persuade them over to your cause. And that's exactly what any type of advertising is, and no less with politics. And what that was doing was using more, was just specifying that messaging to each individual, and I think that was a very clever thing to do. And you know, the morals of it we can debate. Clearly you're not as against those methods, and it's maybe
so let's just very quickly on the ethics point, the question is at what point persuasion becomes manipulation. That's really
yes,
the line
exactly.
we're trying to draw, and I don't think there's a clear line there.
No.
I also think, interestingly, that points to the fact that Cambridge Analytica is not a sort of binary change. Cambridge Analytica was the 2016 point on the ever-complicating spectrum of advertising. And I think the thing with... We're not going to... This is where we probably were... I actually don't think we necessarily disagree about the facts on the ground for most of the thing. I think we will disagree fundamentally on this. And I don't think there's a way to actually isolate this, but... I think the impact of Cambridge Analytica is massively overstated. I mean, there are thousands of companies that have been doing what Cambridge Analytica has been doing for a very, very long time, probably better than what Cambridge Analytica does, maybe not what it, you know, claims to do. And I really do think... and I think people should go read about this for themselves, because the history of this is a lot deeper than people think. It's not like Cambridge Analytica is an outlier in any sense. It's part of an industry... But that includes hundreds and thousands of companies that have been doing this in elections across the world for years. And really, this is... personally, and I know some people who are mildly involved in this sort of thing, the Cambridge Analytica targeted advertising was primitive in comparison to most of the stuff that goes on across the world, especially in the US, mainly because the amounts of money were just not the same. There are very strict campaign financing laws in the UK.
Do you disagree with the fact that Cambridge Analytica was the first time that kind of political advertising had been used in UK politics?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, people have been on Facebook, in basically every election ever since Facebook was created. The Conservatives and Labour have been paying to place adverts in specific constituencies, to place different adverts to different age groups. I mean, it's not even...
Yeah, but that's
yeah, that's the whole point. That,
primitive in comparison to Cambridge Analytica.
So the Cambridge Analytica thing is... This is why I think it's important, is sure, that is, yeah, more primitive, let's say, than Cambridge Analytica. The Cambridge Analytica thing was not particularly... I just don't think it was particularly brilliant either. I don't think it was that much further than that. And
I think it was... this is where we disagree. I think that was far, far more... I would say I'd use the word sinister. I suppose you probably wouldn't, but I would use the word... I think it was more sinister than that because it was looking at... detailed demographics.
I think fundamentally we're not going to come to an agreement on this because neither of us quite know enough. From what I've read about Cambridge Analytica, I feel like it was slightly overhyped. I think the reason it has that slightly sinister feel is because it makes for such an easy, compelling narrative. You know, surprise election result. Ooh, dark tech firm with lots of AI and lots of data points on your psychometric levels and that sort of thing. I'm not sold by it. Anyway, I think fundamentally we're not going to agree on this because, you know, we neither of us know enough about A, Cambridge Analytica, or B, targeted advertising.
No, and as you say, from what I've read, I've seen that Cambridge Analytica used a lot of individual data points about a person to try and influence, to change the type of advertising they saw. And advertising to a specific geographic location isn't that... you might even be able to do that in Facebook, as in choosing where that advert goes, but maybe not. But developing, like... algorithms that will, you know, specify certain advertising, I think it's more sort of sinister. But as you say, neither of us know the ins and outs of this and exactly how sinister
the ethics
that was.
Of it is interesting,
we have different perceptions. I think the ethics is a good question. I certainly do think you raise a very good point about when marketing and when sort of persuasion becomes manipulation, and there is a line, and I completely agree that I think anybody agrees on where that line is. You know, if you were to draw the line too far one way, you'd just classify all types of advertising as manipulation, and I think that would be unuseful, not very useful. But if you went the other way, then, you know, you'd allow very manipulative types of advertising that do manipulate and play on people's feelings and emotions.
I think we probably have quite similar intuitions actually about when persuasion becomes manipulation, and I think the reason that I think Cambridge Analytica is not is because I think Cambridge Analytica is less effective than you think it is.
I agree that. Anyway, yes, but yeah, I think we'd like to, just before we end, I'd just like to point out that I'm not saying that I'm actually in favour of Cummings or that I'm a fan of Cummings or anything like that. I just think that his impact was massive, and
no,
you don't think it was.
Yeah.
And there we go, cool.